Hello, listeners, and welcome back to Lifetime Cinema Club. We're just a little podcast undergoing a big project, and that project is we are counting down what I consider to be the top 10 films from each year, beginning in 1980 and going all the way to current day. Now, tonight, we have reached the official halfway point for this particular year's countdown and what I consider to be the fifth best film for the year 1980. Before we dive into number five for 1980, as always, I'm joined by my trusted ally and research mastermind, Holsh. How you doing, buddy?
Really well, Chip. Looking forward to you introducing the something verse that we'll be diving into today. It's been quite the experience.
Yeah, we are delving into a something verse. We're not going into a multiverse like the fucking MCU, so don't freak out. Loyal listeners, you would have joined us last episode as we discussed the film that came in at number six for 1980, and that was Martin Scorsese's Raging Bull, an absolute technical marvel, and one that I still feel guilty for rating so lowly on the 1980 scale. If you are new to our podcast, you can find the previous episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Just search Lifetime Cinema Club, as well as our Instagram and Twitter profiles, which are new and up and going, and we will feature the countdown on those social medias as we proceed. So number five it is, and it is a film that I adore and feel should be more widely recognized and studied. It says a lot in a pretty short amount of time. It's a film bursting at the seams with ideas, themes, raw emotion, and one of the most badass bar fights ever committed to celluloid. Tonight, we discuss William Peter Blatty's The Ninth Configuration.
San Antone, it's really good to see you. It's been a while, but you've been on my mind. I've seen your rolling hills and winding rivers so clear that I could all...
Welcome to Lifetime Cinema Club.
Now, as always, I will begin tonight's episode with a quick read of the plot synopsis. Colonel Vincent Kane is a military psychiatrist who takes charge of an army mental hospital situated in a secluded castle. Among Kane's many eccentric patients is Captain Billy Cutshaw, a troubled astronaut in the midst of an existential crisis. Although Kane's own grasp on sanity is questionable, he manages to engage Cutshaw in a series of thoughtful conversations about science and faith that deeply affect the lives of both men. Now, that is a pretty good rundown on what we will talk about tonight. This is a film, as I said earlier, is a very dense look at what it is to be human, looks at faith, the presence of good and evil in everyday life, in humanity. And it is a film that is the middle part of a, at first sight and at first thought for some people they'd find surprising, it's the middle chapter, I guess, of a trilogy wedged between The Exorcist and The Exorcist 3, or as I like to call it, Legion. We'll start with the actors first before I get into William Peter Blatty, the director. The Ninth Configuration stars Stacey Keach. He's our lead here. He's starring as Colonel Vincent Kane. Now, Keach is one of the great character actors, especially throughout the 70s and early 80s, although he's probably more recognisable to the masses for his menacing role in American History X. For me, though, I'm a real Keach head, and his standout films, for me, the standout stuff was from Fat City, a film that he did in the early 70s, I think 72 or 73. That was directed by John Huston, and it's about these semi-professional, down-in-their-luck boxers set in and around California. That's a great film, Fat City, if you have not seen it. He also had a part in Cheech and Chong's Up in Smoke, which is almost ground zero for stoner comedies. He also had a fairly prominent role in 1980, another 1980 film, The Long Riders, which I know you just saw, Holsh, and which just missed out on this very 1980 countdown. I think it was not either probably number 11 or number 12 for me. where he played Frank James. What did you think of The Long Riders? I know you just watched that recently.
Absolutely loved it. Walter Hill movie. And yeah, look, I was actually watching it on the plane heading down to Melbourne, but I was riveted from start to finish and the time sort of passed really quickly. It's got a tremendous back 20 minutes at the end of the movie. And yeah, all the actors, it's quite a interesting cast in that it's got the three sets of brothers that head it. So the two Keaches are in there. But yeah, no, Stacey has his sort of similar dry role that he does here in the ninth configuration to a degree.
Absolutely. And like you said, stacked cast. That is a great film. And Walter Hill is just, I keep throwing out goats, but when it comes to genre cinema in the late 70s through the 80s and kind of creeping into the 90s, not too many. I guess John Carpenter would be up as another kind of king of the genre cinema through that era, but Walter Hill is right there with him. And The Long Riders was a great film. And like I said, fuck, just a smidge outside the top 10. Starring alongside Keach in the ninth configuration is Scott Wilson, and he stars as Captain Billy Cutshaw, a pivotal character in not only this film, but the entire Blattyverse, which we'll touch on again. He plays the astronaut that has basically had a meltdown. He's undergoing an existential crisis. And Scott Wilson was also known for a bit role, a smallish kind of role in Exorcist 3. Obviously, like we're saying, this is all going to tie in and we'll explain that later. And he's probably most recognised from his stint on the Walking Dead TV series, a show that I quickly lost interest in because I could feel it was just going around in fucking circles, but it had a huge cult following during its peak. Scott Wilson played a character called Herschel on The Walking Dead. So any Walking Dead heads out there, this is Herschel we're talking about. A few other notable actors that I want to mention too include Jason Miller. Now, Jason Miller played Father Damien in the first Exorcist and also reprises that role as Patient X / Father Damien in Exorcist 3 Legion. Doesn't play Damien in this film, but him just being in this film is another link in that entire trilogy. Ed Flanders is another actor in this film who plays Colonel Richard Fell. Very pivotal role, and we'll talk about Richard Fell shortly. And last but definitely not least, we're talking about our boy who had quite the 1980, Joe Spinell.
And what's the name of his character in this?
Very creative, Lieutenant Spinell. Now, I know you shit your pants when you realise Joe Spinell was in this.
When you talk goats, like this guy has to be the 1980 cameo goat. And I know he obviously has also some feature roles in the movie Maniac as well. But 1980, he must have just like dropped from one scene and ran across to a different set for another film. He seemed to pump them out that year.
Just a legend. Just an absolute legend. Like, obviously, we've spoken about him. He featured as a really sleazy, disgusting, and who I think potentially murderous cop in the film Cruising, which came in at number 7 for 1980. And he also, like you said, he also had roles in about 4 or 5 other prominent films from 1980. Dude was on one that year. He was on one. And before we go any further, a really funny behind-the-scenes ninth configuration story that I do want to touch on about Joe Spinell is apparently during filming of this, he went to a bar with a few of the other actors, got absolutely hammered drunk, and got into a big, big fight with some locals. And they were looking at, this is in Hungary, obviously, they were filming on location, and they were looking at deporting Spinell for how badly he carried on. Someone at the police station or I don't know where recognized him from his bit role in the original Godfather and were like, oh, hey, yeah, you that the dude, you're one of the assassin characters from, and he was like, yeah, yeah, that's me. And he started rattling off all of these really funny behind the scenes stories from the Godfather. And that single-handedly kept him in the film and in Hungary to complete filming.
That's why he's our boy.
Oh, he's our boy, Joe Spinell.
I actually watched the movie Melvin and Howard last week as well from 1980, and he has this bit part in there as a strip club owner, so small, in fact, that wasn't even credited in the movie.
What a perfect role for him.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
It was like in 1980, if any directors thought, oh, fuck, I need to find someone really sleazy and weird and grimy, and I just, oh, we'll ring Joe Spinell. He was like in the speed dial Refidex for these people back in 1980. We need a real sleazy dude. Joe, can you do a little cameo for us? And he did it. And he was the king of it. Now, as for the director of The Ninth Configuration, William Peter Blatty only ever directed two films, The Ninth Configuration and Exorcist III. He wrote both of those screenplays, and both were originally novels. And he also famously wrote The Exorcist, which won him the Oscar for Best Screenplay in 1973. Blatty started out as a comedy writer initially, though, which is, I always find that hilarious. And his biggest success before starting the Blattyverse, before writing The Exorcist and then the subsequent novels after that, he penned one of the entries in the Pink Panther series from the 60s, starring Peter Sellers. And I think the Pink Panther film that he wrote was called A Shot in the Dark, which was probably one of the most successful of all the Pink Panther films. That's an interesting insight, because The Ninth Configuration, despite all its deep theological discussions and themes, has so many elements of slapstick comedy through it that initial viewings can be a little bit off-putting. And before I go any further, all of these films that we pick and have picked so far are films that I would definitely encourage multiple viewings of, because they all kind of unveil something different each time you watch it. None of them, though, besides maybe Bad Timing that we've done so far, I would say you definitely have to watch this twice. I would encourage you to watch a few things twice, but this film, The Ninth Configuration, is one that I would thoroughly encourage two or three watches. And it's a pretty breezy watch considering the depth of theme that goes on in this. It's an enjoyable film, and we'll touch on the reason why it's an enjoyable film as we go on. But yeah, before we go any further, this is a film that your first viewing, there's a few tonal differences. It goes from slapstick comedy 1 minute to psychological thriller within the blink of an eye.
I concur completely with that. Like, personally, for me, on that first watch, especially early on in the piece, it is definitely a what the fuck film. Like, it's just so much going on, so many characters. It's so theatrical, especially in the first half of it. And I was like, holy cow. I finished watching the movie. I quite enjoyed it. But at the end of it, I still really didn't comprehend everything very well, because I didn't have the context. But then the second watch, I appreciated this film so much more. And to be honest, I've watched it three times. It took me till the third watch to love this film. I agree. It's got that comedy side, but it's also got that absurdity side. But at the same time, it's got like a really dark underbelly to it, to the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's definitely one of the most offbeat, esoteric films that I have ever seen. And it's a shame that more people out there have never even heard of this film. So hopefully this episode can bring it to light for a few.
Absolutely. And I understand the confusion that a lot of people would have felt in 1980 when this came out, and still to this day. It's one of these films that I see on a few sites like Letterboxd and IMDb and things like that, where people are either on board with it or just completely disregard it.
Mm.
And I can't be mad at people, because, you know, if you're only going to watch a film once and only have time to watch something once, I get it. Life is busy. But this is something that you really do need to watch a few times to truly enjoy. That just jarring change of pace between comedy and like you said too, Holsch, there is a really dark, menacing tone to this film. And it's there from the get-go with subtle imagery that comes through.
Yep.
But it really ramps up towards the end. But again, it offers a slightly optimistic and fulfilling ending as well at the climax, which we'll get to later on. I don't want to jump too far ahead. Tonight's episode of Lifetime Cinema Club 2, I'm trying to avoid going from A to B plot-wise as well. For a film that is this thematically dense with a lot of theological meaning and discussion through it, it's something that we're just going to have an open conversation about, I guess. And you touched on it before too, as far as how the film looks. The first thing I want to say is that it's shot on location in this incredible Gothic castle in Hungary, which is where you get your scenery shots from. But everything internal is very stage-like. It's like you're watching a play.
Today I watched, for the listeners, I watched the Blatty commentary, and he explained that they actually only went to the castle 3 days in the entire
thing. Okay.
The only imagery they used at the castle was actually the outside. All of the internal shots are created sets. They created these in Budapest. They couldn't actually use that particular castle inside because it was a major, major tourist attraction, and it was actually right in the middle of Budapest. In the scenery that we see, it looks like it's very isolated, and it's meant to be because that's part of the metaphor for these men in the film. It's so beautiful, all the sets, that I thought they had to be the actual castle themselves.
Well, the recreation of those castle imagery is incredible. And like you said, it's set in this idyllic, misty mountain, and it's meant to be set in the Pacific Northwest of the United States, where these discharged ex-Vietnam veterans have gone to wash away the PTSD, I guess. Yeah. It's the last operational secret military psychiatric hospital, I think they call it. And it's just basically a ragtag bunch of ex-military loons who are suffering from post-Vietnam psychotic syndrome. In essence, Colonel Kane, which is played by Stacey Keach, has been assigned this role to turn up at this castle to assess all of the, I don't want to call them inmates, but they basically are, all of these ex-military people suffering from mental conditions, to verify whether or not they are faking it or not, to verify whether or not they are just faking this to get out of their duty, or whether or not they are truly insane. The castle itself is an incredible structure, and then the recreation and sets, like you said, Holsch, what I love about it is it just shows that it's madness surrounding madness. They have all of these mentally ill individuals in this Gothic-style castle with all this almost satanic imagery all around, with like goblins and ghouls, and even this one kind of, and it's played for, I think, a bit of comedy, this massive poster from the 1930s Dracula movie in the middle of the living space. It's combining this Catholic religious imagery with these Gothic and mythical creatures, and again, slightly satanic style imagery. And that combination is incredible. It's preceded by, actually, on Colonel Kane on the way to the castle, he's being driven by a chauffeur, and he's having these like apocalyptic religious visions as he sleeps in the back of the car. I really love that blink and you miss it kind of image, Holsch, where it's this misty kind of plane with the three crosses.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I love that. And again, it's playing on the fact that you get straight away that Colonel Kane is a man of faith, and he is trying to find meaning in his faith as well. And you kind of get the hint right from the beginning that whilst Colonel Kane has been assigned to assess these individuals, that he is also not completely right in the head as well.
The way that he uses his gazes and facial expressions right from the get-go, it's pretty obvious that, there's something going on up top.
It's an incredible performance, actually, and probably one of my favourites from the year that we've covered so far, 1980, where Keach both looks confused at times, looks lost, and you find out why eventually towards the end with the big reveal. And also looks with pity towards these patients at the beginning, at least.
Yeah, I always think haunted the way his facial expressions are. There's something there, and you can tell it's distressing him, but you can't put a finger on it.
Absolutely. That's probably the best way to describe that. Real thousand-yard stare. Right from the get-go, you know that this is going to be a thematically dense and strangely menacing film. And despite that, we're still, again, like we said before, we're thrown with a few of these slapstick style scenes. Like there's a running theme or a running joke through it, where a lot of the inmates are trying to train a bunch of dogs to recreate a Shakespeare play. And that's just showing, obviously, that A, they're absolutely batshit crazy, and B, that this is a Shakespearean tale of sorts. I just love that. And one thing that really stood out to me this time too is what I love doing, going through a lot of these films, like I say old movies, and I can say that now because this is 44 years old, this film, and was written years before that, is seeing modern films, their take on this same kind of premise. It doesn't click with me until I've rewatched these older films again. And right from the get-go, I'm thinking to myself, this has been lifted, a lot of the theme, not a lot of the themes, but a few of the plot devices in this has been lifted by Martin Scorsese for his film Shutter Island. Yes. Have you seen that, Holsh?
I have. Love it.
Yeah. And got about 20 minutes into this, and I'm like, I can see a lot of where Marty probably would have pulled from the ninth configuration for Shutter Island. This film has quite a strong reveal and a really interesting reveal. I don't want to use the word twist. And it revolves around Colonel Kane. Now, the original title of the novel that William Peter Blatty wrote wasn't called The Ninth Configuration. It was called Twinkle, Twinkle, Killer Kane. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. 1966.
So it was written not long after he wrote the original Exorcist. And if you're wondering what the ninth configuration, the title means, apparently it's an equation that is said to prove the existence of God.
Captain Cutshaw, Vincent. In order for life to have appeared spontaneously on Earth, there first had to be hundreds of millions of protein molecules. The ninth configuration.
Vincent.
But given the size of the planet Earth, do you know how long it would take for just one of these protein molecules to appear entirely by chance?
Vincent.
Roughly 10 to the 243rd power billions of years. And I find that far, far more fantastic than simply believing in a God.
So pretty deep subject matter there. You know that we're going in the deep end here theologically.
Now, I'm not a religious guy at all, but this movie puts forward some really great evidence to support there being a God. That equation that you speak of that Colonel Kane explains there, like when you sit back and think about, you know, the chances of just the universe creating what we're living in today is basically nigh on impossible. Then
yeah,
maybe for a lot of people or maybe it's true. It's makes more sense to believe in a God.
I'm like you. I am completely non-religious. I'm a proud product of the state schooling system in Australia, which would be an absolute shock to nobody. But I have a real affinity and I'm always attracted to films that touch on people having a crisis of faith or weaponize faith as well. And this film and the entire Blattyverse ticks all those boxes for me. That's why I find The Exorcist, The Ninth Configuration, Exorcist 3, just compelling and some of the greatest films I've ever seen. Now, before we go any further, we do, I guess, have to touch on how the ninth configuration is connected to The Exorcist and Exorcist 3. And it's only a relatively small link, but it is a vital one. And there's one that is a through line through all three of these films. And that is in a somewhat almost throwaway scene, and I guess it's in a film that's full of iconic scenes, which is, I'm talking about 1973's The Exorcist, there is a dinner party at the household, at Regan's household, and she approaches a gentleman that is at this dinner party who happens to be an astronaut who is about to go to the moon, and she goes up to him and quite a chilling scene, terrifying, and quite calmly says to this astronaut,
"You're going to die up there."
Which just horrifies the astronaut who just doesn't know what to say and is very confused. That astronaut is Captain Cutshaw, who is the same Captain Cutshaw who is having the existential crisis and is an inmate, again, don't mean to use that word, but as an inmate at this castle, we see footage of him at the beginning of the film have a freak out as the shuttle is about to take off and basically has to get removed from the spacecraft, saying that he doesn't want to die up there. His scenes throughout this with Colonel Kane, with Keech, are some of the great dialogue scenes that I've seen in a long time. They are so fascinating, the way they both bounce off each other, go back and forth. Probably my favourite scene in the entire movie is their first real passionate discussion, Hulsh, about the existence of true good in the world.
To hell with it.
You're convinced that God is dead because there's evil in the world?
Correct.
And why don't you think he's alive because of the goodness in the world?
What goodness?
Everywhere, in man.
You're committable.
If we're nothing but atoms, molecular structures no different in kind from this desk or that pen, then we ought to always be rushing irresistibly, blindly toward serving our own selfish ends. So how is it that there is love in this world? I mean love as a God might love. And a man will give his life for another.
Never happened.
Of course it happened.
Give me one example.
It happens all the time.
Name one example.
A soldier throws himself on top of a live grenade to prevent the other men in his squad from being hit.
That's reflex action.
A shipwrecked survivor in the middle of an ocean finds out that he has typhoid and deliberately goes over the side of the lifeboat to keep the others in the boat from contracting the disease. Now, what do you call that, reflex action?
No, I call that suicide.
Suicide and giving up your life are not the same.
You're so dumb, you're adorable.
The essence of suicide is despair.
The essence of suicide is you don't collect the insurance. Listen, who doesn't know but what all these examples we keep on hearing about aren't bullshit? I don't have some basically bullshit, selfish explanation.
I know.
I don't. Now give me one example, just one, that you know of personally. Personally, just one.
I really like the approach, because I'm a bit of a pessimist, if I'm being honest. So I'm more aligned personally to how Cutshaw sees the world. And basically his attempt at trying to break down Kane's faith, I guess, is that there is no true good in the world. Kane uses hypotheticals like, well, what if someone laid down their life in place of someone else, saved someone else's life by giving their own? Wouldn't that be a sign of true a true sign of faith, a true sign of good? And Cutshaw keeps saying, well, no, it could be for selfish reasons. Maybe they're just trying to selfishly gain entry into a heaven if there is one. And there is a line that Cutshaw says in this, and it's so good, and it always sticks with me, is, and the line is as follows: the essence of suicide is you don't collect the insurance. It's such a great line because it's got a comedic tone, which is in Blatty's history, coming through as a comedic writer. But it's got so much depth to it as well, and so much heft to it. Scott Wilson just delivers that with such a great, it's just such a great line read.
To put it in context as well, Cutshaw is the only inmate that hasn't been to the Vietnam War. He's that outlier in being the astronaut. And in that moment, Kane has said, you know, what if someone put their lives on the line for someone else? And he's basically demanding him to give him an example that he knows personally. And he can't give an answer personally. He could bring examples in the greater universe, but he couldn't give anything. And I think that really comes into play later on in the movie with the climax.
Yeah, it gets proven actually with the climax as we'll get to it throughout the film. And look, this is a very dialogue heavy film as well. And to be completely honest, not a lot of action outside of some funny slapstick moments of comedy within the castle until we get to towards the end of the film. One thing I've noticed on the last watch was knowing what the reveal is, and I think we will reveal the reveal shortly just so we can discuss it, is that whenever whenever Colonel Kane is having a one-on-one discussion with another inmate, Fell is always present. For context, when Colonel Kane arrives at the castle, it is to basically replace or to oversee what Colonel Fell is doing as far as assessing the inmates. So Colonel Fell's basically the lead psychiatrist at the time, and Colonel Kane's coming in to oversee what's going on there and basically, I guess, take over Holst. Would that be correct?
Yeah, that's the way I portrayed it when I watched it the first time.
So without knowing the relationship or if there even is one between Fell and Kane initially, you just kind of take that as face value. But knowing what the big reveal is and going back and watching this again, this is why seeing this film a few times, it's quite fascinating. You do notice whenever there is a one-on-one conversation or a seemingly one-on-one conversation going on between Kane and one of the inmates, that Fell is never too far away from the discussion. And the reason being is, as we find out about, I guess, three quarters of the way through the film, Colonel Kane, Stacey Keach, isn't the actual Kane that we think he is. He is Killer Kane, a Vietnam War veteran that snapped on the war fields and single-handedly killed, did they say 30 or 40 people?
Yeah, I think it was around the 40 mark.
Basically, men, women, children just absolutely snapped, had a psychotic episode, and with his bare hands and knives and, I guess, other weapons, by the sounds, but wiped out a small village by himself. Now, delving into it, he's obviously a man of faith as well. This has made him have a complete psychotic episode to the point where he has tried to erase his identity as Killer Kane and absorb his brother's identity as a psychiatrist. And then we find out in a really touching scene as well, Holst, that Colonel Fell is actually Killer Kane's brother, but he doesn't recognize his own brother because through this psychotic episode, he's basically erased his brother and has taken over his identity to try and soothe his guilt and his remorse at what he did. And that scene, Holst, where they're talking about his past, Killer Kane's past. Colonel Fell says, and what about your family? Do you have any family? And he's discussing his family, and then he says, I had a brother.
Oh, well. Hey, how is your brother, by the way? You know, I met him once over in Korea. Kind of palled around together, as a matter of fact. I like him. I like him a hell of a lot.
He's dead.
And then he walks out of the room and just breaks down because he just realized that Killer Kane has completely wiped him from his memory.
A bit later on in the film as well, he invites him to go out to breakfast and says, oh, what are you having? Fell says, Eggs Benedict. And he's like, oh, that's
my favorite. Oh, I love that scene, yeah.
Where are you going?
The beach. The diner down there serves great Eggs Benedict. You like it?
Yeah. It's my favorite food.
Why don't you come along?
Oh, thanks. I feel tired. I think I'm going to lie down for a while.
Excuse me. Sure. Well, I was hoping you'd come along, pick up the check.
And obviously, he just wanted to have that interaction in some way with his brother, and then he sort of just shuts it down again. And it's really obvious once again. Like, I'd had no idea on the first viewing, really. I mean, once the reveal comes, but a lot of these other little subtleties throughout the film, and that's why it's such a beautiful film to reenact with a few times, because Fell is actually also a really incredible performance through this, even though it's not as, you know, it's not as in your face as a Cutshaw or Vincent Kane.
That is such a sweet, it's a heartbreaking scene, that Eggs Benedict scene. It really is. Mm. It's a really touching moment. And like you said, Ed Flanders is incredible in this. He doesn't get to show out or do anything overly dramatic in this. There are some really touching scenes. But like you said, Scott Wilson performance and the Stacey Keach performance, they are the crux of this film.
Mm, for sure.
Those are the two that are going at each other intellectually and in terms of their faith. But that performance by Ed Flanders as Kane's brother, who we find out three quarters of the way through is his brother, is incredible as well. So essentially you can now realise that Colonel Kane hasn't been sent there to overlook or to look after or assess these inmates. They've basically used this. They basically have told him he will be in charge of this to try and unlock some of his trauma and try and make him realize and come to terms with what has happened and try and move past this denial that he's been going through.
And I think it also raises the question, I think, are individuals who are, you know, clinically sane, are they the best equipped to help people with similar mental health issues? Or, you know, or someone like Kane, even though, you know, obviously he's suppressed his past, his personal experience, and obviously in the film he ends up having this incredible connection with the inmates. So to me, it's like Blatty's also questioning, are the psychiatrists and that in society really the best people to help people that are going through these issues? And it's got to be said, in this film, we're talking about a whole ton of Vietnam vets apart from Cutshaw, but there's really not a lot of reference to the Vietnam War apart from those odd flashbacks from Kane himself. It really does pose a heavy question to me that this guy, who has obviously got mental health issues, is also a great solution for these other guys that are dealing with some really heavy stuff.
That's a great point, because if you have never suffered through madness or depression, anxiety, how are you able to fully understand or empathize with people who have?
That's right.
And even though Kane is unaware that he's even suffering through things like that, it is made pretty obvious to the audience throughout, and that just ramps up through it as well, and to the point where we get towards the end a slight flashback of Kane in the jungle with one of his army mates trying to tell him to fall back and to stop doing what he's doing, but he's just gone fucking berserker mode, and you see some dead bodies all around him. I wouldn't call it graphic, but it's quite a harrowing scene. Probably the big scene that everyone talks about with the ninth configuration is the one real action scene in the entire film, and that is the huge bar fight that happens at the conclusion. It's talking of going berserker mode, we get Colonel Kane going berserker mode, but he is pushed into that. He is antagonized greatly and triggered greatly. I do want to make note, though, Holmes, before we go any further into it, of the incredible hair acting of the lead biker in this scene.
He apparently is like one of the star B actors of the era. He was in a lot of B movies.
Is he? I haven't done my research on this. Who is he?
I honestly don't know, but I read something about, you know, this bloke was in tons and tons of B movies and such a, because his face is very recognizable.
Oh. And I've just done a sneaky little letterbox search, Holsh.
Here we go.
And the actor's name is Steve Sandor.
That's him.
And the photo of him is, his hair is fucking amazing. And from two dudes who have gone bald, we are more than allowed to fanboy over some beautiful hair. The rest of his career is, like you said, holy shit, full of B movies. So the ninth configuration would be the one, I guess, critically accepted legitimate film that he's done. The next entry as far as popularity on Letterboxd is a film called Fire and Ice from 1983. He did a film called Striker, and it's spelt the real rebellious way, Stryker. That looks like a kind of post-apocalyptic Mad Max kind of riff.
I was just going to say, he reminds me of one of the Mad Max crew.
Yeah, actually he does, especially during this bar fight. It's fucking crazy. And he's got this incredible amount of eyeliner and eyelash makeup on too. But anyway, this scene comes about because Cutshaw just needs to get out of the castle. He goes to the local bar, which is located nearby, which is funny because you would think at a psychiatric hospital that's run by the military, housing all of these absolute fucking looney tunes, you wouldn't think that'd allow them to leave that easily and go to a bar. But anyway, Oh, yeah. I'm not going to add too much criticism to that. It is a movie after all. But we're at a bar and Cutshaw is trying to enjoy a drink and the bar is filled with a bikie group. And the lead bikie is played by Steve Sandor, beautiful hair. And he basically comes over and just starts antagonizing the shit out of Cutshaw, recognizes him from the TV as the astronaut that had an absolute freak out. And just basically starts calling him a pussy and a coward and all of these things. One of the barmaids can see some shit's going to go down, realizes that Cutshaw is a patient at the hospital, rings the hospital, gets Colonel Fell. Does he get Colonel Fell or does he talk to Kane?
I think someone did notify Kane. So I think it was one of the other lieutenants came in and told Kane, and then he basically made the decision he wanted to go by himself.
Wanted to go and look after. So Colonel Kane still hasn't – there's been a few little triggers. Like there was the Vietnamese boy at the church, the altar boy. Mm-hmm. Upon seeing the altar boy, Colonel Kane had a bit of a triggering moment back to the war. So there has been hints that another psychotic break is on the horizon for Kane. Nevertheless, he leaves, he goes to the bar to try and support and get Cutshaw out of trouble. And by the time he gets there, Cutshaw's basically being tortured, would you say? Held up against a post, they're slapping him, they're throwing drinks on him, calling him every name under the sun, and he's just not fighting back. And neither is Kane when he first arrives. But then the degradation starts. And some of this is really hard to watch too, Holsh, isn't it?
I think what makes this scene so incredible is how much they drag out the antagonization, because Sandor, every time that there's some sort of interaction, he pauses and just holds it and really makes sure that these victims essentially, he's just not wham bam, thank you. He's like, I'm going to really make the most of this. And it's noticeable. It's a very long scene, but I think it has to be to have the effect that you end up getting from it.
Yeah, there's more payoff because the more sadistic good old Stevie Sandor is, the more realistic the more earned the aggression and the psychological break that Kane has. And it's a really rough scene to watch because they're basically degrading Kane, slapping him around, and he won't fight back yet. What breaks him is that they start to enforce and tell him to start saying degrading things about the Marines. It culminates in Kane basically laying waste, just like he did in that village in Vietnam, to an entire bar of bikies, and no one is spared. I don't want to sound – this is going to sound terrible anyway I say it, Holsh, so please back me up. Besides Steve Sandor getting absolutely fucking axed in this scene, the other person I loved seeing get beaten to shit was that woman. That sounds
is
terrible.
It the one he throws against the wall?
Or, yes.
It's like, I think she instantly dies. It's like blood on the wall.
I think she's blunt force trauma against the wall. I think she's dead on impact.
There's two moments in that, and they're both from Sandor that I really stick with me. And the one where Kane is being forced to drink the beer off the floor, and just prior to it, Sandor does like the Blades of Glory split with his legs.
Yeah, that's right, he does too.
So they can get down on the same level as him. And then the other one is when Kane does snap completely and the camera's looking up towards Sandor's face and he's holding his glass, and his expression as Kane reaches out and crushes his hand into the glass. Incredible, and the makeup on his hand for the shards of glass is just first rate, unlike Sandor's other movies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right. It was that. I love that crushing of the glass in his hand, and the lighting in that scene too. Holst, like the neons that from the neon bar signs that are like throwing like pinks and reds across the faces. It's so gorgeous to look at through such a crazy scene. And look, it probably showed up really nicely because you watched the 4K of this, didn't you?
No, Blu-ray's as high as it goes at the moment. There's no 4K, but yeah, no, I watched the Blu-ray and still looked outstanding.
Well, I'm still rocking the YouTube version, bro, so I'm a bit behind you there. But it's such an incredible scene. But I will say that when, because that woman, oh man, she pissed me off. So, she did something really bad to Cutshaw minutes before she earns what happens to her. And I again, loyal listeners, I abhor and do not in any way encourage. No, that's the wrong fucking word. Violence against women is fucking terrible. All right?
Yes, correct.
There we go. Violence against women is terrible. Unless you're this heartless bikey woman who is torturing somebody else and is absolutely asking for it, then I will laugh at your demise. I took great joy in seeing Colonel Kane absolutely smash her.
He's ruthless, though, that with everyone there. It's just, it's, you know, it's when we talk about how much the whole scene was dragged out to have that real presence of them wanting to put this pain on, you know, these couple of victims. Then when Kane comes about, it all finishes in less than a minute because he just wipes them out so quickly. So it's a real contrast to the first part of the scene because he's just like, oh, don't fuck around. It's over now.
Absolutely. And look, and with this scene and with this explosion of violence that we've known previously that Kane is capable of, he doesn't come away unscathed. And it's not obvious at first, but he does acquire an injury. It's not until they're back at the castle with Cutshaw. And there's this really touching scene when Kane's sitting in a chair and covered in like a sheet. And we don't know the extent of any of his injuries as of yet. And they're having another one of these theological discussions, and Cutshaw has become quite vulnerable at this time. Obviously, he's been through a pretty traumatic event at the bar. And he basically says along the lines, I just like the threat that Regan gives him in The Exorcist. He just basically says, I didn't want to die alone up there. I didn't want to die alone. And that is basically what we find out to be the root of his fear and his anxiety through the entire film is that he needs connection and he wants connection. And I know that you found a really interesting symbol or connection through the clouds surrounding the castle from the start of the film through to the end as well, Holsh.
I think the castle is a really strong representation of the inmates and how it starts with that incredible fog. It's like one of the coolest fogs you're ever going to see in a movie. And I think that really hones in on what the minds of these men are like, not just Cutshaw, but, you know, all the guys. There's the depression and just that foggy brain. And Scott Wilson and all the little connections to this not wanting to die alone. You know, at the beginning, there's that, I think it's just one of the most incredible scenes. Well, there's two, actually. One where the moon comes up behind the rocket and the moon has been enlarged in such a way it really dwarfs the rocket that it's an imposing, almost menacing figure.
I find that vision so scary.
But at the same time, it's just awe-inspiring. It's scary and the both. And then later on, Cutshaw is on the moon. This is actually a Kane dream. That's when we see what is supposed to represent Jesus being crucified on the moon. And that's once again where Cutshaw's like, does anything really exist? And Kane's trying to put in his words, how can I, you know, make him believe this? And that particular scene is interesting because that is actually Stacey Keach on the cross. And Scott Wilson is in the suit in that dream. You can't really tell.
I never knew that.
So, yeah, all of these really all come together. And then in this final scene when he explains, look, I'm terrified of dying alone up there. Is there a greater being above us? And it's kind of, it's scary, like, to think if you didn't believe in anything at all and you went up there and you thought you were going to die or a chance of dying, fuck, I'd be scared too. So
absolutely. Faith is the thing that can drive you to do those incredible things, I guess.
It gives you
like that kind of safety net in a way.
Yeah. It's an incredible performance from him because he can be comedic and sad almost at the same time, the way that he distributes lines right through this. And you could write three pages of classic lines that he delivers in this movie. When you look at it, it all still comes down to this fact that he's scared of dying alone. And everything he says throughout it makes sense when you realize, you know, what's really haunting him.
Yeah, no, 100%. The thing that I missed the first few viewings was there's a kind of a blink and you miss it scene towards the start of the film, Hulsh, where Colonel Kane, Killer Kane, is writing his initial reports about the inmates, and it just looks at a piece of paper and he writes, I think, shock treatment, comma, required or will work or something along those lines.
Curative, it says. Curative.
Was it curative? That's it. And he kind of underlines it quite a few times. And you take that on board as basically they're going to start to perform actual shock treatment on some of these patients. Mm. When you see the conclusion, and the conclusion and spoilers, but you know what, we are a spoiler. We're a spoiler podcast. Sorry to tell you people. Kane essentially sacrifices his life to shock Cutshaw back into sanity, I suppose, back into a sense of self. It was something that kind of confused me for a while, because you see briefly in the bar fight Kane get injured, but then it kind of alludes to the fact that he self-harms and hurts himself underneath that blanket back at the castle. What's your take on that?
This is the most talked about moment in the film. Blatty said today he's made 32 cuts of this film, and there was 18 different cuts released at different times, different countries.
Wow. Fuck. What's the definitive cut? Did he mention which one is the definitive one?
This is hilarious, because the definitive cut, as far as what's been released now, is that he has used the knife to end his own life. And that is what was shot originally. And what happened was, Stacey Keach was, while we're here, do you think we should just do another shoot and have one where just my hand comes out and essentially I've faded away from the injury during the biker fight and lost my life that way? And then, but apparently there was a director's cut that was released some time ago and it had that version in it. Anyway, Blatty confirms in the commentary that he prefers the one with the knife. He thinks it's more dramatic. Obviously, he actually mentioned that shock treatment curative, and that's why they went for that in the end, is because it had a more shock effect to cure Cutshaw.
You know, it feels to me, personally, I think I would have preferred if he died from his wounds from the bar fight, but let himself bleed out.
That's exactly what I was thinking, and I was going to ask you this exact question. Continue.
I would prefer that, because I think that tracks more honestly to their initial conversation when Cutshaw was saying to Kane, sometimes these so-called self-sacrifices are self-serving, are a selfish thing to say, well, look how good I am. Give me my interest into heaven, right? Mm. And essentially by him suiciding, by stabbing himself to end himself, is playing into that. So then you would think Cutshaw's mindset wouldn't be changed. Whereas if he leapt to his defense at the bar like he did, suffered a life-ending injury like he did at the bar, I think that would be a more valid example of pure self-sacrifice that Cutshaw was truly looking for an example of. When he was asking Kane, you give me an example of something like that happening, an actual example, and he couldn't give him an accurate, just gave him anecdotes and hypotheticals. I think it would work better if he had inflicted an injury at that bar fight and died from that rather than harming himself. Does that make sense?
I actually agree completely. And the first thing that went through my mind was when he takes his life, to me it almost looks like, okay, I'm about to get in big trouble with the authorities for what I've done, and I now know who I am. I am Killer Kane, and I don't want to go through that again. To me, it feels like it has more reason to do it for himself,
yes,
by taking his own life. Whereas if it was all because of what he did directly to help out Cutshaw at the bar, then the self-sacrifice was purely for him. That's just
absolutely
the way I see it.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. And I've always grappled with that ending because the version I've seen, which was a downloaded version on a torrent that I downloaded years ago, and then I've lost that and I've only got the YouTube to rely on, it is that one where there is a knife present. You still see the injury at the bar. So I've always kind of conned myself into believing what I wanted to believe in that moment. It makes more sense to me that he has passed away from that injury at the bar, and maybe he was just carrying a knife at the same time and he's just dropped it out of his pocket, you know?
And I can see from a cinematic point that the knife coming out, it does have a lot more oomph to it.
Yeah, it does. It's a lot more dramatic at that note at the end, for sure. That type of ending, and this is the type of film that really gets to me and that I end up adoring, is these, you know, ambiguous type of takes that you can take from it. Even though Blatty has said this is a definitive edition, well, I'm very happy that we're both on the same kind of wavelength for that conclusion, Holsh, on how we'd like to define it. Do you have anything else that you've discovered in the research? Because I know you're my research guy, man. You find out some real deep cuts on this stuff. So, anything else you want to discuss?
Well, I've just got a couple of things, but before I jump into them, one thing that we talked about how incredible Keach's performance was, but one thing, and Blatty brought it up today, and I'm sure, like, for everyone that watched the film, it's just something that really sort of gets under your skin, is how amazing Keach's eyes are. There's a particular scene where he's speaking to Groper, who's the guard that sort of gets picked on and the like throughout by the guards and him. And he's having a big whinge because they're having to dress up as Nazis because Keach is letting them play out the Great Escape movie, basically. And
that's such an insane fucking part of this movie, too, by the way.
It's incredible. It's so much fun. And Groper's like losing his shit. And then you see Kane's eyes. He goes from calm, and you can just see he's starting to lose his shit, and his eyes widen and start to shake, his head shaking, and within 30 seconds or so his eyes turn completely bloodshot. It's insane. And Blatty was saying that he did not know how the fuck he did it, but he would do this, and by the end of it, him screaming at Groper, he's got, like, basically red eyes, and then they'd finish the take, and if they did it again, he'd just put some eye drops in, wait 5 minutes, and he'd do it again. And he had
That wasn't a practical effect. That was purely physical.
That was just something that Keach could do off the bat.
Inside. That's incredible.
So for everyone else, if you watch it again, just watch how red his eyes go, because he does it again in the final scene, obviously, with the bikers as well. But I think you can really see it strongly when he's facing off with Groper.
You do notice it more in that scene, for sure. But I always assume that was like a practical effect, or they've done something to his eyes. That's incredible eye acting. Stacey Keach, eye acting goat.
The goat. And while we're on Kane, whenever there's heavy rain in the film, that's when he has his flashbacks, etc. And Blatty mentioned that this was because when we see that scene where he decapitates the boy with a piece of wire, the young Vietnamese boy that we also see in flashback in the church, it's bucketing rain. So whenever rain is torrential in the film, that's when you find that Kane just loses his identity and starts to fade back to his old self. So much so that the scene in the moon, on the moon with the crucifixion, he actually recorded that with pouring rain as well. And he said it was so magnificent and he wished he had kept it in. So it was actually raining on the moon while they were...
Yeah, I was going to say raining on the moon. That would have been an incredible effect.
Yeah. So, yeah, he talked about it quite a bit that he could tell. He was like, man, I wish I'd done that. So there was that. We also didn't mention that Blatty acts in the movie himself as Lieutenant Fromm, who is the doctor that, or fake doctor in
there. Yeah.
And I think he's just amazing throughout the film.
He plays that so well, man. And it's funny because the first time I watched this, I did not realize that was Blatty, but upon these rewatches, the first rewatch I had, I'm like, oh, that's my boy Blatty, right from the fucking get-go, right at the... Isn't he the first dude that greets Kane out of the car?
Yes.
And he's like, oh, yes, I'm the doctor. How are you? Come on in, and all this kind of shit. And everyone's like, no, he's not. Such a good role.
Yeah, incredible. And while you're at that, like, that also has the inmates... when he first lands, us singing You Are My Sunshine, which I never, ever until the last watch, and I know I texted you to say, you know, that's also very metaphorical because when Cutshaw returns to the castle at the end of the movie and he's now back at NASA, his life's back on track, he's got a promotion, there's no clouds anymore, there's no fog, it's not overcast or anything. It's just a beautiful day and you can see the castle clear as day. So it really was that Kane ended up becoming the sunshine for this group of men. And the last thing, and this was a huge contemplative find for me, was talking about the dogs acting out Hamlet with Jason Miller and our boy Spinell pulling it together.
Spinell, yeah.
So there's that big dialogue piece where Jason Miller goes into the office and is talking about Hamlet, and he states,
"Now, Colonel, considering how Hamlet is acting, is he really and truly crazy?"
"Yeah, no."
"You're both wrong. Now think what happens. First his father dies, then his girl leaves him flat. Then there's an appearance by the father's ghost. Bad enough. Then the ghost tells him he was murdered. And by whom? By Hamlet's uncle, who recently married Hamlet's mother. Now that by itself is a hell of a hang-up, because Hamlet liked his mother a lot.
But then we're agreed, Hamlet's insane."
"No, he's not. He is pretending. But if Hamlet hadn't pretended to be crazy, he really would have gone crazy."
The first two times I watched this, I sort of just dismissed this, but this is a huge thought provoker for this film in that these guys that are in here, they've been to the Vietnam War, they've been through absolute hell, and now they are hidden away in this mental hospital or asylum of sorts. Are they sane? Are they insane? What this discussion that Jason Miller is talking about with Hamlet is, if you don't act insane and you try to live a sane life, will that in turn make you insane?
Drive you insane.
And it makes sense. Like, they're basically creating an alter ego so that they do not have to be sane, which would probably provoke them to think about their past. So
yep.
There's a number of people in there that are potentially completely sane. You know, the guy that's dressed as Superman, the fellow that's hitting the wall because he wants to teach the atoms a lesson because they're not, you know, they're not playing their part so he could walk through the wall and all these.
Well, there's even like that Al Jolson scene where they're dancing in full blackface in front of the one black inmate as well.
That's right. And to me, I just feel like this is probably one of the top three things for me that I got out of the film is when I watch it again now, it's like, fuck, if these guys have gone through all this craziness, maybe acting like someone else is the way to not go insane. And it kind of makes sense. And one of the guy that actually is Lieutenant Benish, the gentleman that is doing the blackface with the Al Jolson song, they were meant to start the film with a scene where it was in the Vietnam War. So they'd had intended to have a Vietnam War scene where a young American soldier is shown to help an injured old Vietnamese lady, and he puts her on his back and walks for miles and miles back to the camp so that they can help her. And he puts her down gently, puts his rifle down, turns his back and starts walking away when this lady just reaches into a dress or what have you and pulls out a grenade and throws it at the guy that helped him. And you don't see him explode, but Captain Benish, the same gentleman that is dancing to Al Jolson, he basically, it goes to his face and it just shows blood like splatter all over his face. And that's meant to set the tone for what these guys have gone through. But what happened was they got to Hungary and they were promised all these Vietnamese actors, and Blatty mentions that they had one and it was just a child, and that's why.
Oh, it was the altar boy.
It was the altar boy. So he still used him, but it meant that they had to change the entire beginning of this film because the song San Antone that started it was originally going to be in the middle, and he felt it was distracting, so he moved it to the front. And then when he couldn't do the scene that he wanted, that's when he created that moon scene with the giant moon coming up and dwarfing the rocket ship.
And look, that scene is so iconic now too. The other little interesting tidbit that I've learned tonight from you, Holsh, and I learn new shit from you every episode we do, is when you said that it was actually Stacey Keach on the cross on the moon.
Yes.
Well, I've done a little bit of private eyeing. I've done a little bit of investigating as you've been talking, and I have pulled up a copy of the poster and zoomed in, and that is definitely Stacey Keach on the cross. You ain't lying, man.
I don't lie. I don't lie. I don't want to listen.
You don't lie. I can't verify if that's Cutshaw in the suit. Obviously, it's in a suit. I can't see who the fuck's in there. But that is definitely Stacey Keach as Jesus on the cross.
Yeah, and obviously he was Cutshaw's saviour, so it makes sense.
It all comes around. What an incredible film. And again, for a film that so wonderfully balances comedic aspects and slapstick with such deep issues, it doesn't feel jarring anymore. Again, like I said to begin the podcast, it is a film that upon first watch, I do expect some people to think that the whiplash between these surreal, crazy slapstick scenes and the deep theological thoughts that go on later on, it could be too much for some people. But there is merit to it, and there is reason behind the madness.
I'm really passionate about this film now, and I honestly, you need to give it its chance, let some context really seep in so you can enjoy it and love it like we both do.
Absolutely. And look, it's a necessary part. If you are interested at all, if you have seen The Exorcist, which a lot of people, most people, film-loving fans would have seen The Exorcist, this is a vital connector between The Exorcist and The Exorcist 3, which obviously comes out much later in 1990. And hot take territory here, Holsh, as much as I love The Exorcist from 73, and it's an absolute bona fide classic, I'm riding with Exorcist 3 as my favourite of the trilogy, man.
Wow, I can't wait. I've got it coming in 4K. It's on its way.
It is a certified banger. It is such a good round out, close out to the Faith trilogy. Everything is so good about it. And it's another film that was kind of butchered a little bit by studio interference, I think. But nevertheless, back to the ninth configuration. If you are at all interested in this, in seeing The Exorcist play through to The Exorcist 3, this is a vital kind of connector between those two, wouldn't you say, Holsh?
Well, I haven't seen the third yet, but I love the connection that it has to The Exorcist. So, and I love The Exorcist. So now when the number three lands, I've got a feeling I might watch all three in one weekend.
I think you must. I insist that you do so. Well, that's us. that's us. We are down to the business end now. That is the fifth. The film coming in at number 5 for 1980. We're going into top 4 territory next week, and next week's film is an epic, both in theme and in length. It is a big film. We've got a lot to sink our teeth into. Like always, we'd like to thank everybody for listening. We've got friends of ours that are reaching out and saying they're listening. We're seeing people pop up all the time. By all means, if you're enjoying the podcast, please like and subscribe, follow, download, whatever you need to do on both Spotify and Apple Podcasts. We've got a couple of socials up and going. We've got the Instagram and we've got Twitter. Please send us some messages if you want to talk, discuss about films that we've spoken about. If you want to try and get some juicy gossip about what could be coming up, I'm not going to tell you what's coming up, but I might give a few little hints here and there. But you can find us on Twitter and Instagram, Lifetime Cinema Club, on both of those socials. That's it from me. You got anything else you want to say, Holsh?
Not at all, mate. That was a really fun episode. A really great movie to be able to do a podcast about.
It is so much fun to really sink into, and it's a film that I hope now reaches a few people that have never seen it before. So that was The Ninth Configuration, number 5 in our 1980 series. For number 4, check in next week. And, yeah, thanks heaps. We'll talk to you all again soon.